My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the November 1st Forum, featuring Darren Woods, Chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, Darren Woods, Chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil, engaged in a fireside chat with Jay Hooley, former Chairman and CEO of State Street. The conversation focused on the energy sector, leadership, ExxonMobil's recent acquisition of Pioneer Natural Resources, what is needed for a successful energy transition to clean energy, and the role of oil and gas companies in that transition.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Boston.
It's good to be here.
Friendly place. I want to start with way back. Darren mentioned a little bit, Warren mentioned a little bit, the Wichita, Kansas. He was son of a military man who traveled all over the world. In fact, Darren told me last week in a casual conversation that he's lived in 22 different places in his life. A lot. But so, you went to high school in Hawaii, obviously Wichita, grade school, moved around, and then you went to college at Texas A&M and then Northwestern. And so my first question is just reflecting on those early years. Who was most influential to you? And what were the traits that you learned in those early years that have served you throughout your career up until today?
Yeah, well, I think maybe I'll start with the what in terms of what influenced me, because I think that moving around and constantly being the new kid in town, being the outsider, especially as you grew older and got into adolescence, was a really challenging time for me. And I think as you move and go to different high schools, I think well, three different high schools, you have to, at some stage, decide, are you going to try to judge yourself around what everyone around you thinks when that keeps changing every couple of years? Or are you going to establish your own set of values and judge yourself based on what I'd say is more of an internal compass? And I chose that latter, probably out of just self-preservation, frankly, is judge myself based on what I've come to be through this experience of moving around. That philosophy or that mindset has, I think, really played an important role in the job that I do today, because I focus kind of who I am and what I believe in and trying to do the right thing for the right reasons in the right way, despite what I would say is maybe the conventional wisdom or the criticism that comes my way. And I think a lot of that, withstanding the pressure that you're very familiar with, Jay, that I went through, I think, frankly, that childhood experience prepared me for that. I mean, with respect to who, I take a lot from my parents. I mean, I think that moving around drives your family closer together. And so my father and my mother were really big influences. They both grew up in the Midwest, really strong work ethics. My father had a very can-do attitude. I can remember from a very early age, every time he's a big DIY, do things, wanted me, every weekend he had me working. And I can remember a number of times where I just said, I don't know how to do that, and his response was always, figure it out. You better figure it out. And that mindset to me kind of continues on, so there is no can't, there's only how, and go figure that out. And so that's lived with me for a long time. And my mother came up through, she was an assistant working at a roofing company, surprisingly enough, and eventually became the president and CEO of that roofing company. And so she's kind of a self-made woman. And so her work ethic and the things I saw her do were a big influence. And so I'd say both my mom and my father were good role models for me growing up, their work ethic and their values. And then the final person I would just mention is my wife. She's kind of kept me out of the ditch when I was younger. We met when we were in high school. We met when we were 17, and we went to college together and got married right out of college. And so they always say behind every maybe good man is a good woman, and I always say she was way out in front of me, and I kind of followed her. So she's been a really important part of my success and kind of my life.
Great. So Exxon, kind of a career Exxon man. 2016, you'll recall, Darren's predecessor, Rex Tillerson, gets the call from the White House to come down and be Secretary of State. The board goes through its evaluation and deems you the next CEO of Exxon. So my question, which is multi-part, is that something about that time, you were, at that point you had been with Exxon 20 years, that you decided that dramatic change was needed. You know, you set out to, I'd say, dramatically change the organizational structure, take $10 billion of cost out, begin to hire senior people from the outside, set up Low Carbon Solutions, which was the effort to lean into the energy transition. And so my two-part question is, you know, what was it about that time, having been a long-term Exxon person, that concluded in your mind that not subtle, but dramatic change was needed? And then how did you lead that change?
So I think, you know, one of the philosophies of our company and what we generally do is hire people at very early ages coming out of university, and then we grow that talent up through the company. And we put a lot of effort into development of our people. And I can remember at a very early age in the company that, you know, one of my responsibilities was to find the next CEO and develop that person. And so there is a very strong culture of development. And part of that development process, particularly for people who are recognized as having the potential, we move them very quickly into a lot of different jobs that challenge and stretch and develop people. That's part of our development process. And so you're constantly, and the company consciously makes a decision to sacrifice what I would say is the short-term benefit to the job to develop the person for bigger and better things going forward in the future. So that's the development process I went through. Company was putting me, you know, the course of my career, I ran a trading organization, I ran a shipping organization, a retail service station business, a refinery, pipeline system, and so I've had a specialty chemical business. So a lot of different jobs through the course of my career. And there's always, I think of two approaches when you go into a job where you don't really know the background or the experience that, in terms of looking at the job. You can focus on being a success in the job, or you can focus on making the job successful. And I'll just, you know, in my mind, being a success in the job is focusing on yourself and how you do what's expected of you so that you are seen as being successful. Making the job successful is figuring out what's the potential of this job and where can I take it. That was my approach from very early, and not because I was looking for some kind of payday on that. That's what, I'm an engineer by trade, that's what satisfies me. That's what, the ability to find the opportunity to make something bigger and better was always kind of what inspired me. So every job I had going through the company, despite being a, you know, a company and being an ExxonMobil for life, was coming in and figuring out what could I do to make this a better place, more productive job, and redefining that job. And so almost every experience I had with the company, I redefined the jobs that I was in based on the objective of making it better and leaving something behind that was better than I found it. And the company strongly encourages that. We, you know, despite the traditions that we have, there is a very strong expectation that you improve and make things better. And so I was always encouraged to continue to do that. Of course, with that change came a lot of accountability. If you got it wrong, made the change wrong, you suffered the consequences of it. If you got it right, you moved on. So coming into this job, Jay, I came in with the same view. And frankly, when I first took the job, I wasn't actually gunning for the job. I wasn't that interested because I knew at this stage, it wasn't a job, it became a lifestyle. If a company needed me to do that, I had a tremendous sense of loyalty and obligation to the company that I would take it, but it wasn't something that I necessarily aspired to. And so coming into that job, I didn't go in with a mindset, I'm gonna change everything. I went into the mindset of understanding where could I take this the job to and where could I take the company to. And frankly, growing up in the company, I never felt like we were delivering to our potential. With all the jobs I had and the different places I moved through the company and the people that I knew and the capabilities that we had, it always felt like we were somehow fighting with one hand behind our back. And so coming to this job, I was very conscientious of how do I unleash what I believe is the full potential of this company. which then led me to start thinking differently about where can we take this business, where are the challenges. And when you get to that level, you can then look across all the businesses at that altitude, you can really begin to see what I would say were some of the things that were inhibiting our ability to be successful. And so started on that journey back in 2018 to deconstruct the organization and unwind essentially every part of the business and reconstruct it. And that's the journey that we've been on, and we've kind of made some final changes earlier this year. Got one more to come that will, when we get through this series of change, we'll make maybe a slight adjustment going forward, but I feel pretty good about where we've taken it to. I think the trick in terms of managing that is the organization had been pretty static for 20 years, and so a lot of the people who grew up in the company almost defined the business based on how we organized ourselves, which was a problem in and of itself. And so I recognized that, you know, making this change when a majority of our people had defined their jobs, their business, as the organization that they were working in, was going to take some time to start unwinding and to demonstrate there's a different way of thinking about the business. I also knew I couldn't spend a lot of time talking about that broadly, because the ability to relate to that concepts that I had, I think, would be challenging. And so we did a lot of the moves early on without really the proper context for the organization, which was a bit challenging in terms of people trying to understand what Darren and the team are doing. Very early on, I decided, historically, you grew up in the upstream business, and then you as you rose into the ranks of the management committee, which are the direct reports that report to me, you managed parts of the business you grew up in. I decided in 2018 to take an individual who grew up in the chemical business primarily and put him in charge of our upstream business. And I took a person who grew up in our upstream business, and I put him in charge of our chemical and downstream business, which was extremely radical concept at the time. Well, I think it still is radical for our company, but the idea there was we had a lot of people who understood how to do the upstream business and the chemical business. What I wanted is a leadership team that brought a different perspective and worked on how do we get the most out of this business without really being encumbered by the paradigms of those businesses. And while at the time it was somewhat controversial, it has proven to be very effective. And that was the first, that work which began to manifest itself in some of our early results and thinking gave us some momentum. And then as we made changes and put more points on the board, people began to see the benefit of the changes that we were making, and the momentum started to grow. And then we got far enough along the change journey that we could then kind of put all the pieces together for the organization and explain the strategy and how these pieces fit together, which is kind of where we're at now. So I think the organization today understands our strategy, understands how the organization we've put in place supports that strategy, and frankly sees the benefits of that organizational change now delivering results that historically we've never been able to deliver, and I think are up for the next change and feel good about where we're at. So that's kind of how we've gotten to where we are.
How would you describe Exxon's business strategy today?
So I growing up in the company, we've always talked about some of these core competitive advantages, and they were our scale. They were the fact that we ran a number of businesses that were integrated. So think about, you know, running an organization that produces crude and running an organization that refines crude into products. We had a technology function that we felt like was a competitive advantage. We have what we call functional excellence, which is really around the ability to execute with excellence. And then our people. And those were always the kind of the five core competitive advantages. And my challenge to the organization was show me where it's impacting our performance and our bottom line, the ability to deliver above and beyond what competition can deliver on. And the work was either we figure out how to fully leverage that and it manifests itself in our bottom line results and our competitive positioning, or we stop talking about it. But to talk about it and not demonstrate the value proposition was unacceptable to me. We spent a lot of our literature, if you go back in time and read it, you know, there's a lot of, I call them superlatives and chest beating. And I told them, you know, we're going to stop using adjectives to describe, we're going to be very matter of fact. And I said, you know, the sign of a successful company is when other people use superlatives, not doing it yourself. And so really focused on making those core competitive advantages that I went through real competitive advantages. And so we focused strongly on how are we going to bring that to bear and either make it work or get rid of it. And our strategy is really around leveraging those capabilities to lead industry, using those capabilities to be seen as an essential partner that anybody that's out there that needs to work with our industry or work with companies in our industry sees us as the preferred partner. It's bringing innovative solutions, using our technology to provide solutions that others can't. And so that's been the focus, is leveraging those competitive advantages. And I think we've, to ourselves at this point, demonstrated that all five of those, what we envisioned or talked about historically, are indeed true competitive advantages. And today, I would say we've strengthened them. We've got more work to do, but we're fully leveraging them. And I think now really differentiating ourselves in the competitive sphere.
So I'm new to oil and gas. 3 years, I think, on the Exxon board. And what's fascinating is that to learn a new space, it's I can't get enough of it. The so as I describe the business, there's a conventional side of the business, which is what we would know as things like offshore drilling. There was an article, I don't know if you saw it in the Wall Street Journal today, which talked about Guyana, which is one of the premier offshore drilling locations in the world. Exxon discovered it. They typically do it with partnerships, so Hess, soon to be Chevron, the Chinese organization involved. So the traditional, conventional, what they say, side of the business is kind of the offshore drilling, the natural gas. And then the unconventional is what we would know as fracking. So that was a discovery in the 1990s, I'm going to say. And it was, you know, the world was struggling for oil supply, and all of a sudden we look and right within the United States is this rock that can be fracked with new techniques to release oil and gas, and it was just, it set the U.S. on the course of energy independence. And so I want to talk a little bit about fracking, because the Pioneer acquisition that Warren mentioned is right down the center of that fairway. And as a setup, I wouldn't have thought of oil and gas as being an innovative or a technology-driven business. But talk a little bit about the unconventional business, our business, and why the Pioneer acquisition made so much sense.
Sure. So fracking, it's been around since the beginning of the industry, frankly. But in terms of its application in the Permian space in West Texas, if you saw the rock that you're extracting the oil from, it looks like granite. It is as solid can be. And what fracking is, essentially you drill a well through it, and then you blast that rock and crack it open, and then the oil comes through those fractures, and that's how you pump the oil. And so if you go back in time, it was extremely expensive technology, and in the early stages, not that productive. And so the economics of it looked extremely challenged. We got into that high price oil environment where crude was above $100 a barrel. Well, that provided a lot of incentive for the industry to innovate and find more economic ways to frack and produce that oil. And that the learning curve drove the cost of that production way down very quickly. Frankly, as a company, a large company, we missed that as an opportunity. We never thought the economics would be that attractive. And so when it became clear that we were missing out on what was going to be a large potential resource base, at the time we bought a company called XTO, which is really our entry into trying to buy into the capabilities of fracking, and frankly didn't recognize the full potential of what fracking could bring from a resource development standpoint until after we bought XTO and paid for it, which is one of the criticisms that the company had with respect to that deal. But we got into the business, and one of my challenges for a long time, because of our organizational construct, we kept that XTO business separate from the rest of ExxonMobil. And I never felt like we were really bringing the benefits of what ExxonMobil could bring to bear into the unconventional space. And so when I got in the job, one of the things I said is we're playing this game like all the other people are playing the game, all the independents, all the small guys. We're not a small guy. I used a baseball analogy, which I'm not sure is appropriate because I don't really watch a lot of baseball. But I was like, they're playing a short game, we're long ball hitters. And so, is that okay? I said, what does a long ball game look like in the unconventional space? I mean, when we get up, we go for the home runs, we don't go for the infield stuff. And frankly, nobody had ever asked that question. And so we started thinking differently about if we were to bring all that ExxonMobil has to bear into unconventional, can we create a unique concept and a unique advantage? And so that's what we set the organization on the path to do, and focusing on technology, focusing on our capabilities. And over the course of the last 5 years, we have come up with unique approaches and technologies for more effectively recovering the resource out of this rock that looks like granite, and doing it at a lower cost. So we're getting more recovery at less cost, which is, you know, that's magic in this business. And my view was, if you can come up with that advantage, then you can create deal space and open up an opportunity for an acquisition. So we had invested in better, more productive mechanisms for extracting the resource, and then what you needed was an inventory to apply it to. And Pioneer had the best acreage position in the Midland. Really, it's in the sweet spot, the fairway of that basin, and so really, really good acreage, but didn't have the same capabilities that ExxonMobil had developed. So when you think about taking what we have learned, the development approach and the technology, and then applying it to the best acreage and the best resource in the Midland, you create a lot of value from that transaction. So that was unique deal space, and that's what opened up the opportunity to transact. And what it's created for us now is an opportunity to apply all those advantages that we've created over the last 5 years to an inventory level that has a 15 to 20 year life. And frankly, we justified the deal and talked to the board about, we're going to justify this based on what we've demonstrated today. We're not justifying this deal on an aspiration or a hope and a wish. We're justifying it on what we've demonstrated on a lot less productive acreage. We know we can now apply it to this more productive acreage. We've got a lot of upside because there's a technology pipeline that we've been working on that has yet to convince ourselves that it's going to bring the advantage, but we're pretty confident it will. And so we think we've got a lot of upside to the deal as well, but we weren't going to build that into our base case economics, and so feel pretty good about where we're at today. And you know, frankly, the opportunity here is we're going to recover more oil at a lower cost, which is good for the U.S. economy. Marginal cost of supply is going to come down. We're going to basically produce more oil, so good for U.S. energy security. And we've taken on the commitment to, we're taking our Permian operation to net zero by 2030. Pioneer had an aspiration to get to net zero by 2050. We've taken that aspiration and made it a plan for 2035. So we're bringing forward their net zero by 15 years, and it's not an aspiration, it's a plan we're gonna put together to make that happen. We know we can do it because of what we've been doing in our own footprint. So good for the environment. So from our perspective, it's, you know, no matter what angle you want to look at it, and then we're going to create unique value, which is good for our shareholders. So it's, you know, win, 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 win. Those don't come along very often. And so that's why I keep telling my team, this is what magic looks like in the upstream. This is what magic looks like. So we feel really good about it.
Let's pivot to the climate challenge. Oil and gas industry has been pillared a little bit about, you know, being at the center of this. As part of your strategy, you talk about the and equation, which is the conventional and unconventional businesses, and then there is the energy transition. And your and equation resulted in establishing an organization called Low Carbon Solutions. I'd like you to comment a little bit on what you view Exxon's role is in the energy transition. And I'm going to come back to, if you were the ruler of the world and you had this net zero by 2050, what has to happen? So start with Exxon and then broaden it out to say, what policies do we need, what changes do we need to make this a reality?
Yeah, so this is a space, and Jay got kind of involved in it in kind of the depths of the 2020 pandemic, but at this intense period of time when there's a lot of folks out there that thought that, you know, this was the end of the industry. You know, there was a very simple narrative around the energy systems of the future will all be wind, solar, electrons, and therefore the role of oil and gas is going to be limited going forward. that was a very, I think, superficial way of thinking about it. We definitely believe that wind and solar and electric vehicles are going to play an important role, and they're a necessary part of the solution, but they're not sufficient in and of themselves. So there's got to be a broader solution set. Because we talked about ourselves and others talked about us as an energy company, there was again, I think a somewhat superficial view that, well, you're an energy company, you should go into wind and solar. Wind and solar is power generation. We provide fuel to power generators, just like we provide fuel to mobility and car manufacturers. So the logic was, you're providing fuel to power generation, you're an energy company, you should go into power generation and go into renewables. And my view is, we don't bring a lot to that space other than a checkbook. And frankly, we don't think our investors need us to write checks for them. If they want to write a check, they can do it directly. What we bring is a solution. So we're not an electron company. And the question is, you know, we're a molecule company. We manage and transform molecules, and we've been doing that for 150 years-ish. And people forget we're one of the largest chemical producers in the world. What we looked at is, we're good at molecules. Is there a role for molecules in this space? And carbon capture and storage, hydrogen and biofuels are all molecule solutions that frankly all independent objective analysis out there tells you are going to play a role in the transition. You know, at this stage, given the challenges associated with transforming an entire global energy system, we need as many solutions out there as possible. And we got very focused early on, our society got very focused early on based on a very narrow narrative that says you got to get rid of oil and gas. And so it turned into, from a address the emissions that are causing climate change or have the risk of causing climate change, to get rid of oil and gas. And what we're focused on is actually, let's stay focused on the problem statement, which is we got to get rid of the emissions. And whatever's most cost-effective to do that should be the solution that society is going for. And we've got to start bringing in a more thoughtful approach to the policies and the approaches that we're taking that comprehend cost, because this will not be free. And if you go back in time and listen to the discussion, nobody brings up the cost. It's got to be affordable. Society cannot afford to change this if the cost is too high. And so what we've been very focused on is, with the scale that we have, the capabilities, our core competencies and these competitive advantages I talked about play directly into a transition solutions in the molecule space. And so our view is that's where we should be focused. And Jay, to your point, what is our role? We've taken on the role, we feel like we have, in our traditional businesses, been a leader of the industry, and we've challenged ourselves to demonstrate what leadership looks like in this space, in the transition space that focuses on the molecule side of the equation. And let others who know how to manage the electrons do that. We'll focus on the things that we know how to do in transition and focus on the molecules and the solutions that those can bring the cost down. Because to your last point of the question of how are we going to get to net zero by 2050, we got to get costs down. Today, the solution sets that we have are not practical when applied to the scale of the global energy system that we have. And so while it will work in certain pieces or parts of or subsegments of the energy system, which is great, extrapolating that to the entire world's energy system, and at the same time comprehending the billions of people who are living in energy poverty that have to be, whose needs are going to have to be addressed on an affordable basis, when you factor all that in, we don't have the solution sets today. None of us do. So you hear a lot of people criticizing carbon capture and storage as not being the ultimate solution, and I would agree with that. We don't have, society doesn't have an ultimate solution, but we've got a portfolio of solutions that we should get started on. And our view is, let's get started on the things we know how to do that work today and get better at them and drive the technology evolution. So we're going to need, to get the cost down, we're going to need advances in technology. And frankly, there's not enough work going into that space. We've got a lot of work we're putting in ourselves to try to drive direct air capture. We think it's going to be a really important part of the solution set. So trying to get the cost down today. Today, it's not economic. But can we get the cost down? Can we use technologies? And so a lot of technology advances are going to be required. We're going to need solid, consistent policy that's thoughtful, that helps the transition, because big discontinuities are going to disrupt society, and we're going to set ourselves back. I mean, and I would use as an example the Russian invasion of Ukraine, how quickly Europe converted from gas to coal to meet the needs of their society, because energy is such a critical part to economic growth and people's prosperity. So we have to recognize the absolutely essential role that affordable energy plays today and figure out how we continue to provide that while we address emissions. That's going to require some very thoughtful, consistent policy that today don't see much of around the world. And then ultimately, the third thing I say we're going to need is we got to transition to a market. Governments cannot afford to pay for this indefinitely. And so while we have started the business today using some government incentives, I think of it as a catalyst to get us going and get us down the cost curve. But we're working really hard and advocating as much as we can that we got to transition to a market. Because without the market forces, we're not going to get to the best answers. We're not going to get it as broadly applied as we need it, and we're not going to get it as fast. But the challenge with that is it becomes very transparent. The cost becomes transparent, which I would tell you as you look around the world and the policy that's been put in place, that's the thing everybody's avoiding, transparent pricing. But we're not going to change as a society and convert if people don't understand what that is and then start working on getting that cost down. And so that's the third piece of the equation.
So it's big and it's complicated and it's, I would say it's largely been misunderstood. I'd like to think in the last couple of years, I don't know whether it's my exposure to Exxon has biased that, but the world seems to be coming around to greater understanding of the complexity of this and the multidimensional aspects of it. If you think about there's a portfolio of strategies today from EVs to wind, solar, hydrogen, carbon capture, biofuels, nuclear. And if somebody asks you, like, what's the winning hand? It's all of them. And, you know, the analogy that I like to use when you think about, like, what could success look like? If you look at the EV world, you had some unique players like Tesla in their driving product, but you had government subsidies all around the world. You had regulation which says after 2030, no longer will we allow internal combustion engines, and it looks like it's shifting that's a small example of, I think, what needs to happen in some of these other areas. I'd also say that there's a wall of capital waiting to enter the space, but it's not going to enter the space until it sees the right economics. So I do think that the best thing that I can think of to say is that I think the world is waking up to the reality of what it's going to take, and I think that's all good. Questions from the audience? We have a few more minutes for Darren. Yep, Beck.
Hello from a fellow Midwesterner, Indiana, and I went to high school in Bangkok, Thailand, so I appreciate the multiple school lifestyle. I just returned from Colombia, where gas prices are $14 a gallon. How are we lucky here to not have that? Is one question. And my second one is, how has return to office been a challenge, and what has been a solution for you?
So I think people, when they think about petroleum products and gasoline and diesel, related directly to crude, where crude is the feedstock, and so that those prices float on that. But the other key piece of it is you've got a separate business, which is refining business, that has its own supply-demand dynamics. And so in areas where you don't have sufficient refining capacity to convert the crude into finished products, you have to import those. And so you start to, depending, and then if you have very specific or unique specifications on your fuels, that limits the places you can import it from, and you have to pay the price to incentivize somebody to make those. I don't know about the specifics in Colombia, but certainly in the U.S., in California, if you go to California, fuel prices are very high. And part of that is a lot of the refineries have been driven out of the state. We left the state with our refineries. A lot of regulations that put cost on the refineries that stayed, which raises the cost. And then a very unique set of specifications for that fuel, which makes it very difficult to produce. And so if you're not geared to do that, if any of the existing refineries in that state have a problem or an upset, their ability to source alternate supplies is extremely limited, and so supply demands kick in and the prices go way up. That's generally what you see in that market. And frankly, if you look around the whole of the world, there's a fairly liquid market for transportation fuels. The price setter in the world today is Europe, and Europe has very high natural gas prices, which are used for fuel and refineries. They have a high price on carbon, and so the marginal producer of motor fuels in the world is Europe, which sets the price for all the world, which keeps it somewhat elevated. With respect to the COVID and the return to work, we never had a work from home policy. What we tried to do instead was understand, you know, we're a risk management business. We've got a lot of risk we have to manage in the company. And so when COVID hit, while we complied with all the government regulations, we were also very adamant, I was very adamant, that we're going to understand what the risk vectors are and then manage those like we do every other aspect of our business. If you think about the refineries that we run, facilities that we run around the world, very high pressure, very high temperature, a lot of toxic materials, and so there are a lot of exposures and risk that we manage, far more significant than COVID, frankly, and we've managed to do that fairly successfully over the years. And so how do we take that capability of risk management and apply it here? So office by office, we understood what the threat vectors were, and we managed those threat vectors. So just two quick examples. And the Dallas office, where I was based at the time, it was a fairly old business, so everybody had their own office. And so the exposure for an individual coming into work in Dallas was very low, and so we never closed the office, and we basically said, if you need to stay home to take care of your kids or take care of a loved one or something, then that's obviously that we had the flexibility for you to do that, but your job is in Dallas, in the office, come into the office. And so I worked every day throughout the COVID period in the office, and we made sure that nobody got COVID in the office because of the ways we put up. Our Houston office was an open plan office, and so we had to significantly reconfigure that. But we still brought in a subset of our people. And we were just talking about this at the lunch table. You know, for our business, to Jay's point, doesn't think of this old stodgy oil and gas business as being a place of innovation. I think with your time on the board, you've seen more and more of what's really required to bring, to develop these resources, you know, economically and responsibly. There's a tremendous amount of innovation and collaboration. So frankly, all of our businesses require very close teamwork. Very close collaboration, and we're coming up every day with new approaches to drive better value propositions. We need to be together to do that. The technology work that we do and bringing people, we need to be together to do that. And so we've always said you got to be in the office, and we're only not in the office because of the exposure that we're trying to manage. But when the exposure goes away, your job's back here. Now, we've always had policies in place around flexible work, so if you've got issues, you get doctor's appointments or a parent to take care of or a kid, we always had the option you can work from home on some infrequent basis. That exists today. Big change we've seen pre and post COVID is people are now taking advantage of that policy much more frequently, which is fine because we were encouraging people to use it if you need it. But what we don't want is a structural, sustained absence from the office. And so we're managing through that, but that's been a consistent policy. Some places in the world, they forced people out of the office, and so that's been a little harder to get people back in. But in Texas, there's a little more freedom, and so we've exercised our prerogatives within that freedom.
Any other questions?
Go back there.
You got one out there? Yep.
Thanks. Darren, Dan Gilbane. I've had the chance to work with your organization over the years, most recently with the Houston Campus Project. And going back to where you started with doing the right thing for the right reasons, I'm not sure I've seen any corporation that has the culture that ExxonMobil has. And in our industry, it was really notable in safety. And on that project, you know, we did about 25 million hours with two injuries, which is remarkable, but I'd love to hear a little bit of your take on safety, because working with yourself and Mr. Tillerson and having the chance to experience that, that has changed not only the Houston market, but I think the entire construction market, and then more broadly about ExxonMobil's culture.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I appreciate the compliment too. I mean, for us, there's nothing more important than making sure people don't get hurt in the conduct of our business. And so from a very early age in the company, you are responsible for every person that comes into your facility and conducts business and conducts, you know, helps you conduct your business. And so that is a responsibility that weighs heavily on our managers. And I can tell you, coming up through the company and running facilities that had some of these exposures I talked about earlier, you know, that weighs on you. And you, if you have an injury on your watch, which I have had, you know, I sat in hospital rooms with families, you know, consoling them on the injuries. That sticks with you, and we hold our people accountable for that. And it is, in my mind, this pure intention of we don't want people to get hurt. There's nothing more important than your health and your safety, and we don't want you doing stuff that compromises that. And that's been a really important part of our culture, and we drive that, and it requires a level. If you think about what's required to prevent somebody from getting hurt, in a 24/7 operation dealing with all the exposures that I mentioned earlier, and the behavior and the focus that's required to every day of every minute for all your activities, think through how could you get hurt and how do you prevent that from happening, that requires a tremendous amount of discipline and a rigor and control. And that mindset and that discipline then, in my mind, manifest itself in all other aspects of your business. And so safety for me, while it's the right thing to do from a people standpoint, it's also the right thing to do from a business standpoint, because if you're successful in doing that, that discipline and rigor spreads through everything else that you're doing. It helps with your environment, your environmental performance. It helps with your reliability performance. And so one of the measures that we've used with people, one of the clearinghouses that we have around people who are going to make it to the top of the organization, is whether or not you can run a challenging manufacturing facility because of those types of things that you've got to manage. But if you're successful at that, it gives us great confidence that you can manage a lot of other things because of the behavioral changes that you have to get and the way you have to get people to do things which are more difficult. And, you know, it's easier to take this shortcut, and humans by nature look for easy ways to do things. That's what I think has made us successful as a species. And so you have to counteract this desire to naturally go do what looks like the easier approach, and by consciously recognizing you don't know the unintentional consequences that could come from taking the shortcut. That requires you to actually think through that. That's a really benefit. And if you're a manager who can successfully do that, then our view is you can successfully run a lot of parts of the business. We very much believe in that. And by the way, we take responsibility not only for our own people, but for everybody who walks across the threshold. So your safety statistics, I can assure you, we were holding ExxonMobil people accountable for your results, even though they were your results, because our view is we invited you onto this campus. We have a responsibility to make sure we're doing everything we can to keep your people safe while you're working for us. And that's a really, I think, important philosophy that we have.
Please join me in thanking Darren Woods.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring Darren Woods, Chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.